I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, in a Pennsylvania courtroom, Judge John Cleland sentenced Jerry Sandusky, the former Penn State assistant football coach, to 30 to 60 years in prison for sexually abusing 10 boys. Sandusky addressed the court, claiming he was innocent and that he was the victim of a conspiracy. Several of Sandusky's victims spoke about the abuse that they had endured and how it has haunted them many years later. NPR's Jeff Brady has been covering the story, was in the courtroom yesterday, and joins us on Radio Times. And Jeff, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me, Marty.
What was the atmosphere like in yesterday's courtroom?
Well, certainly the highlight was hearing from three of the victims. Their testimony was absolutely compelling. We're not mentioning the names of the victims, of course, but there was one fellow, a tall, looked like a fit, healthy guy, and he got up there and he was just, he almost sounded like a little boy. He was leaning over his notes and talked about how religion was helping him get through this, and when he actually left to go sit back down in his seat, he almost stumbled. He was just weak from this effort of confronting Jerry Sandusky.
And what was Jerry Sandusky's reaction, if any?
You know, there were three victims who spoke. Two of them did not look at Sandusky, and he watched them as they read their notes. And then there was another one who got up there. He took a deep breath, and then he looked directly at Sandusky, just confronted him right there in the courtroom. And you know what you learn is that people process these things differently. For this particular victim, he wanted to confront Jerry Sandusky, and he did it. And he said, you know, you could have pled guilty and spared all of us the need to testify. And he said, I grew up in a bad situation, and you made it worse. And then he also talked about, he has his own child now. He said, I watch my own child all the time to make sure that something like this doesn't happen to him. And when that victim was directing his attention fully at Jerry Sandusky, I looked over at Jerry Sandusky, and he looked away.
And he looked away. Now, the judge sentenced Jerry Sandusky to at least 30 years in prison. Is that essentially a life sentence? He's 68 years old.
It almost certainly is. And, you know, one thing I noticed in the courtroom yesterday, I was there at the end of the trial, and just 3 months later, Jerry Sandusky looks noticeably older. He was definitely thinner. He didn't look healthy. He looked frail, in a way. Although when he got up and made his statement, he spoke for almost 15 minutes. And he really identified himself as a victim. He said he defiantly maintained that he's innocent and really painted himself as a victim. Some people pointed out that he spent his entire 15 minutes talking about himself, not talking about the victims in this case.
Well, I'd like to play something that Jerry Sandusky sent to a Penn State student radio station. This was the day before the trial, where he talks about, and in fact blames the first victim who went to the police in 2008. Let's listen to just a portion of what was played at that radio station.
A young man who is dramatic, a veteran accuser, and always sought attention, started everything. He was joined by a well-orchestrated effort of the media, investigators, the system, Penn State, psychologists, civil attorneys, and other accusers. They won. I've wondered what they really won. Attention, financial gain, prestige will all be temporary.
And picking up on that, and did he expand on that, Jeff, in the courtroom yesterday?
Oh, boy, did he expand on that. That statement was about just under 3 minutes in length, and he talked for almost 15 minutes in the courtroom. Joe Amendola, Sandusky's attorney, he said outside the courthouse that he had advised Jerry to kind of tone that statement down a little bit because he was very aggressive in that statement. He was less aggressive in the courtroom, but he still said the basic points. I didn't do any of these disgusting acts. I've never had sex with anyone other than my wife. And then he blamed it on the people who, a court and a jury have determined are the real victims in this case.
I'm looking at something else that he said, and it's just excerpts here. This was in today's Philadelphia Inquirer. He said, I've forgiven, I've been forgiven, I've comforted others, I've been kissed by dogs, I've been bit by dogs, I've been a fighter, I've conformed, I've been loved, I've been hated, I've been different, I've been me. I wasn't obviously in the courtroom when he said that, but it seems like an odd thing to say.
It is odd. And how many times did you hear the word I in there? This wasn't about Jerry Sandusky at this point. I mean, the whole trial was about whether or not he was guilty, and through our system of justice and a jury of his peers, it was determined that he is guilty, and the judge pointed this out, and the judge was clearly not happy that Jerry Sandusky had released that audio statement the night before the sentencing. Judge John Cleland said he essentially put it in the category of conspiracy theories, and he said that, like all conspiracy theories, it flows from the undeniable to the unbelievable.
What happens next? And I know that Jerry Sandusky's attorneys are saying that they didn't have enough time to prepare for this trial.
Yeah, you know, this trial did move pretty quickly. I mean, remember, this scandal, it's not even been a year since this scandal broke. It was the beginning of November last year. And by, what was it, end of May or beginning of June, they were in a courtroom presenting opening arguments. So it did move quickly, and I've talked to a lot of legal experts who confirm that that is pretty fast for a case like this in Pennsylvania. But, you know, Judge John Cleland, he runs a pretty tight ship. And those same legal experts say you may be able to just look at the timeline and say that this moved quickly, but I'm not sure you're going to convince anyone that it moved so quickly that you were not able to present an adequate defense. But, you know, just like the conviction of Jerry Sandusky, that looks like that's going to be heard out in the legal processes here.
I heard one of the prosecutors say in response to Amendola's complaint that he didn't have enough time, as they said, well, you had time to go on radio stations or to be interviewed about this case.
Yeah, that was Joe McGettigan. He's the lead prosecutor for the state, and he's got a fun sense of humor. And he is kind of the opposite of Joe Amendola. He rarely talks to reporters. I mean, even after the trial, he came out and said a couple of sentences, and that was just about it. But this time, he was more happy to talk, and he certainly was interested in getting his digs in on Joe Amendola.
And who else was in the courtroom yesterday?
The place was packed. You know, I don't know if this is an adequate measure, but I found it more difficult to find a parking space around the Center County Courthouse yesterday than I did even on the last day of the trial. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people who wanted to show up and see Jerry Sandusky's sentence. So the place was packed, and when those victims were speaking, you could have heard a pin drop. Everybody wanted to hear every single word they said.
Let me quote something else that the judge said to the victims, and he said, the fact that you were assaulted is no cause for embarrassment or shame. His conduct was no fault of your own. As adults, you've now come forward to hold him accountable. It is for your courage, not your assault, that you will be remembered. And it seems like a very, I would assume, heartwarming thing for victims to hear from a judge.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the insidious elements of child sexual abuse, because in our minds, for those of us who are outside of the situation, it's this black and white sort of course, you're a victim, you didn't do anything wrong. But there's so many other different layers of the trust that was developed over the years in the grooming process, that simple sort of process of being able to say, you know, I'm in the victim box, I'm not in the guilty box, that it just doesn't work that way for these victims. And so it was pointed out many times yesterday, a lot of these people, this is not something that's going to be resolved after the sentencing for them. This is a lifelong problem that they're going to have to deal with.
Mrs. Sandusky was in the courtroom and said she has no faith in the legal system now.
Yeah, you know, both at the end of the trial and then at the sentencing yesterday, I tried to make sure I was sitting very close to Dottie Sandusky. At the end of the trial, she was the one who was not looking very healthy. She had lost some weight, and she was pretty emotional at the end of that trial. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, She was a lot more stoic. She was looking a lot better. Her eyes were red a couple of times, but when that sentence was being read, she had her arms crossed and looking straight ahead, and it was clear she had been prepared. In fact, just before the hearing started, Joe Amendola had come over and talked to the family and said, this is going to be difficult, essentially, but this is just part of the process. It's the next step, and it's not the end.
Where is Jerry Sandusky today?
He's back at the Center County Jail. The judge said he'll be there for the next 10 days, and then he'll be taken to the state prison processing facility in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Then he would be assigned to a home prison. I'm not sure that that's how that's going to run down because of this threat of an appeal. They may end up choosing to keep Jerry Sandusky at the Center County Jail to kind of avoid some of those transportation costs of taking him back and forth between the prison during the appeals process. We don't know, but that's one of the things that Joe Amendola speculated yesterday.
Now, the judge has called him a sex predator, which means what, lifetime registration?
Yeah, and, you know, that hearing to determine if he's a sexually violent predator, that took just a little bit of time at the very beginning of the hearing. And that is really only important if, for some reason we just can't see now, Jerry Sandusky is ever released from prison. That's just not going to happen. But if he were released from prison, then this designation as a sexually violent predator would require authorities to keep track of where he is, for him to let authorities know where he is, and then they can go around and warn people in the community where he's living. But it's really, that's all it's about.
This is the first of several trials related to this Penn State scandal. Who's up next, Jeff?
Yeah, as much as we might like a sentencing to be the end of this, it really isn't. We're going to have you've got 10 victims here. There are going to be some sort of civil proceeding happening. Already a case has been filed. Penn State is trying to settle with the other victims. Not sure how that's going to go, so we could see trials there. And then we also have Tim Curley. He's the athletic director who is on leave from Penn State, and Gary Schultz. He was a vice president with the school and has since retired. They're both facing charges of perjury and failing to report child abuse. Their trial is scheduled to start in January.
Almost out of time here, but have you ever covered a case like this before? I mean, this is a highly unusual case, but...
No, I haven't. And, you know, it's really, but one of, I find myself actually comparing this to Hurricane Katrina because this is really a story about a community that's been hit hard by something horrible. And in a lot of my stories, I try to put in an element of how that community is affected. And I have to say, over the last year, I've gotten to know this community a lot better and I'm starting to feel a lot more of a connection with it, just as I feel with New Orleans.
Well, Jeff Brady, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's NPR's Jeff Brady. We have another show waiting in the wings and two more guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Tyler Parks Center for the Arts supports WHYY, presenting Crafts in the Meadow Fall Invitational Juried Craft Show, October 20th and 21st at Tyler State Park in Richboro, Bucks County. Crafts in the Meadow features works from more than 100 fine craftsmen, including jewelry, ceramics, glass, clothing, and more. Highlights include craft demonstrations, children's activities, and music from J.B. Klein, Greg Merkel, and others. Further details and a list of artists are available at tylerparkarts.org.
Virtua and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia's Pediatric Partnership is committed to providing quality care for children in South Jersey. CHOP at Virtua offers a child-friendly environment in Virtua's emergency rooms and children's inpatient units in Voorhees and Mount Holly, featuring pediatric specialists and advanced technology. And now open, CHOP at Virtua's Pediatric Specialty Center and Sleep Care Center in Voorhees. More information online at virtua.org. Virtua is a proud supporter of WHYY.
Philadelphia Hospitality, a proud supporter of WHYY, is pleased to present Philadelphia Open House this weekend, October 12th through 14th. Philadelphia Open House features behind-the-scenes special access tours of more than 15 historical and cultural treasures along the Avenue of the Arts. A schedule of tours and tickets available online at philahospitality.org/openhouse or by phone at 215-790-9901, extension 11.
I'm Marty Moscoane. This is Radio Times. The U.S. use of drones has increased since September 11th and increased dramatically since 2008. They've been used for surveillance to target terrorists and have operated largely out of public view. Their use has raised a whole host of questions. Are they accurate? Will they reduce the terrorist threat? Do they respect the rules of law of war? What constitutional questions do they raise? And are civilians paying too high a price? We have two guests who have joined us today in Radio Time to talk about all of this. Sarah Holwinski has served as executive director of the Center for Civilians in Conflict. They issued a report called The Civilian Impact of Drones, Unexamined Costs, Unanswered Questions. And Sarah Holwinski, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for covering this issue.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Micah Zenko. He's the Douglas Dillon Fellow at the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He writes the Politics, Power, and Preventive Action blog, joining us from the studios of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And Micah Zenko, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you. Happy to be part of the conversation.
And Micah Zenko, let me begin with you. Why are we seeing this increased, dramatic increase of the use of drones in the last couple of years?
Well, the use of drones outside of a defined battlefield, so this is outside of Iraq or Afghanistan, where there were a range of military platforms being used to strike targets on the ground, really begins in early 2008 when the United States decides to expand the battlefield of Afghanistan into northwest Pakistan to go after suspected members of the Taliban, whose primary objective is to take down what they view as the apostate regime in Islamabad, as well as to attack U.S. service members serving in southern Afghanistan. And since then, up to that point, there had been like 40 to 50 drone strikes in three different countries. And since then, there's been over 350. And the most of these have happened under President Obama. I should say, in total, 50 drone strikes were under Bush, 350 under Obama. This is in primarily in Pakistan, but also a few in Somalia and in great numbers in the last 6 to 8 months within Yemen as well, all for a different range of targets. And it's hard to describe exactly why the United States is doing this because, again, as I'm sure we'll get into, there are issues of severe limits in knowing the program because of transparency and oversight and secrecy rules.
And I do want to get to that, but you talked about the numbers of drone strikes. How about for surveillance? Do we know how much, I guess, time drones are spending in the air and how much they're used for surveillance purposes?
Well, so for the United States in 2011, it had 50 drones total, two or three of which were armed. Today, the United States has something like 7,500 drones, and 200 to 300 of them are able to conduct strikes from the ground or strikes from the air. So understand that of the U.S. drone arsenal, less than 5% of them actually conduct targeted strikes. And most of what the U.S. does with these is fly over Iran, North Korea, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and conduct surveillance. Obviously, this is less the issue for the countries and the affected populations on the ground than when you use lethal force, which gets into a whole range of other issues about laws of armed conflict, international humanitarian law, and whether these strikes are actually precise and discriminate as the Obama administration claims they are.
Sarah Holwinski, let me get you in on the conversation, and your report is about the civilian impact of drones. How does your organization or other organizations determine how many civilians have been killed in a drone strike?
Well, the interesting thing is that we can't. Nobody can, including President Obama and his military or CIA. I mean, when you're flying these drones over a place like Pakistan and you don't have boots on the ground, what you're really doing is kind of just estimating. Okay, we think maybe one civilian was killed in this particular strike, or maybe five were, or maybe none were, when actually there were. These places are extremely inaccessible. There's not a lot of media. There aren't a lot of organizations that can get in. It's very tricky to tell who is a civilian and who's a militant. So the interesting thing about all of these numbers that are coming out about civilian casualties is that nobody really knows about deaths and injuries. Nobody really has those numbers. What we do know is that in these communities, they are becoming war zones even without a visible military on the ground. So you've got extreme psychological trauma among the civilians living there. You've got suspicion among neighbors, who is not colluding with the United States or with Al-Qaeda. You've got children who won't go to school, who are hiding under their beds, a lot of displacement. So there are war zones on the ground without looking like a traditional war zone.
But are they frightened because they have drones that are flying overhead? Are they frightened because those drones have attacked people, killed people in their community?
Yeah, it's actually for both. I mean, the drones overhead create this kind of constant buzzing 24/7, and they're actually called mosquitoes or bees in the local parlance. And so you've got this fear constantly about whether or not they're going to strike, where they're going to strike. You know, were you just standing next to a person at the market buying bread who is wanted by the United States, and are they going to strike right at that time, perhaps killing you and your family? Or in a place like Pakistan, where it's very culturally appropriate to have hospitality, so you bring people into your home who need water or food, what if they're actually an Al-Qaeda member or a militant that the U.S. wants to target? We've actually had a case where we've talked with Pakistani civilians who brought somebody like this into their home to feed, and the next day their house was bombed by a U.S. drone strike.
Mike Azeka, going back to you, and the Obama administration has said that they have been able to target and kill leaders of terrorist organizations. Are they correct about that?
Absolutely. Of the 22 out of 30 senior al-Qaeda leaders, as the White House administration officials say, that have been killed, all but one, Osama bin Laden, were killed by drone strikes. But the important thing to understand is of the 400 total targeted killings that the United States has done outside of a battlefield like Iraq or Afghanistan since 2001, the vast majority of people, something like 3,000 to 3,500 people have been killed total. The vast majority of them are not senior members of al-Qaeda. The administration claims that the only people that they target are individuals who are a threat to the United States, who are part of some operational plot, are senior members of al-Qaeda. They have to be a significant and imminent threat to attack the U.S. homeland. And of the 3,000 to 3,500 people that have been killed, the vast majority of them are not senior members of al-Qaeda.
These strikes are determined. There are signature strikes and there are something called personality strikes. Mike Azenko, can you describe the difference between these two strike orders?
Sure. Dating back even to the Clinton administration, there were individuals basically in late 1998, early 1999, where there were individuals who were targeted for essentially assassination. Under President Bush, this expands a little bit, and then under President Obama, it expands markedly. And so these are what are called kill lists, and the strikes against those individuals are known as personality strikes. So personality strikes can be against named individuals who, through an opaque interagency process, are believed to be a threat to the U.S. homeland. The vast majority of strikes are not these, but they're called signature strikes. And in the summer of 2008, President Bush authorized these signature strikes. So these are using intelligence from the ground, from the air, from all platforms. These are individuals who are believed to have the characteristics of al-Qaeda or Taliban militants. And the CIA colloquially calls these crowd killing. Or the Obama administration has renamed them terrorist attack disruption strikes, because the fact of the matter, they don't know the names of these individuals, but they're believed to show the characteristics of al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Now, one significant issue with the signature strikes is these include strikes against paramedic individuals and rescuers of drone strikes. So if there's a drone strike against a compound in northwest Pakistan, individuals rush in order to retrieve the bodies, watch them, prepare them for burial by nightfall, as is Muslim custom. The U.S. has repeatedly struck the individuals who come back to rescue them. The U.S. has also struck funeral processions of deceased Taliban militants later in the day after they've been targeted by a strike. So these are individuals who no one in the United States knows their name, but because they have a association as determined by some process of participating with known al-Qaeda or Taliban officials, the U.S. Targets them for death as well.
Let me just reintroduce the two of you. That's Micah Zenko. He's the Douglas Dillon Fellow in the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. Also with us is Sarah Holwinski, and she's Executive Director of the Center for Civilians in Conflict. We are talking about the increased use of drones and drone strikes in regions of Pakistan, in Yemen, Somalia, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Sarah, picking up on what Micah just said about targeting rescuers, but also trying to understand when it's a signature strike and it's based on certain kinds of behavior or profile, what is that profile about? What does someone have to do or be in order to be the possible target of a signature strike?
Well, as Micah was saying, so much of this program is opaque. So nobody really knows. I mean, within the CIA or certain facets of the military, there are criteria that they use. They could be, for example, that there is a group of, you know, five or more military age, meaning 15 to 70 military age men huddled in a group, and they have weapons. Now, we don't know that this is actually one of the behaviors that the United States looks at, because it doesn't say anything about this in public, but that could be an example of behavior that could get you killed. And so the real problem with this is that it's not a defined civilian versus combatant. It's really based on behavior, and that is not in accordance with international law.
Does it, though, Sarah, turn civilians against the U.S.?
It certainly has, and we're seeing that more and more. I mean, you've got people who have not formally hated the United States, for example, in a place like Yemen, who see these drone strikes and see the U.S. using force. And there was actually a Yemen doctor who tweeted recently something along the lines of, President Obama, we will come after you if you kill children with your drones, having nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. So there are people who really don't support the terrorists, who don't support militancy, but rather are being being turned against the United States because of these drones and the impact that they're having on their communities.
Mikey, you've written about President Ford's executive order saying that no employee will engage in political assassinations. Does this drone strike strategy, in a sense, break that executive order?
Well, the United States made the case, and under Congress agreed days after 9/11, in what's called the authorization for the use of military force. And this basically says that after 9/11, Al-Qaeda created, quote, a state of war against the United States. And wherever Al-Qaeda or its affiliated forces exist, anywhere in the world, the United States can use lethal force against them for an indeterminate amount of time, and with no sort of definitions of when this battlefield starts and ends, no temporal sense of when the drone campaign will end anywhere they're happening, and also no clear sense of what our affiliated force is. And that gets to the issue of signature strikes. I mean, the U.S. claims that the only people who, again, are struck are significant imminent threats to the U.S. They're about ready to conduct an operational plot, another 9/11 against the United States homeland. But again, of the 350 drone strikes that President Obama has authorized, the vast majority of these have not been against individuals who are severe and imminent threats to the United States.
Is there congressional oversight, Micah?
So this is a very good question. There has never been, despite 10 years of these strikes, 400 of them in three or four countries, there has never been a single open congressional hearing on them. The CIA, it's also split, you should know, between the CIA and the military. So the CIA reports to the House and Senate Permanent Select Intelligence Committees, whereas the military special operations community reports to the defense committees. But this is all behind closed doors and secret, and they give sort of a broad description monthly of the targets they're going after. But then the real issue is of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee. These are the individuals who are supposed to provide oversight, broad general oversight over U.S. foreign policy. And if you talk to members of the Senate and House Foreign Affairs Committee, if you talk to the senior staff members, they have no sense of what's going on. They cannot, because they're such a classified program, they don't know how U.S. drone strikes are integrated into broader U.S. foreign policy priorities when they have requested specific briefings. These are even individuals who have high-level security clearances. When they request briefings about what the scope of U.S. drone strikes are in the countries they're responsible providing oversight in, they have been refused them for the last several years. So the Congress has largely punted on this issue. And there's some sense that if after the election there might be some pressure to do some sort of hearing in an open session, but I'm not holding my breath.
Sarah, President Obama was interviewed on CNN about this, and he said that there needs to be five tests. I'm quoting here, it has to be a target that is authorized by our laws. It has to be a threat that is serious and not speculative. It has to be a situation in which we can't capture the individual before they move forward on some sort of operational plot against the United States. We've got to make sure that in whatever operations we conduct, we're very careful about avoiding civilian casualties, that while there is a legal justification for us to try and stop American citizens from carrying out plots, they are subject to protections of the Constitution and due process. Does any of that hold water for you?
Well, it sounds great when you look at each of those and you say, okay, well then, you know, the United States does a good job on civilian protection in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. The problem is when you take them as a whole, what the United States is actually saying is, just trust us. There's no detail in there. We don't know about the training of these operators. We don't know what the rules of engagement are. We don't actually know how the United States could capture somebody that it's going after on the ground when it doesn't have any boots on the ground. There actually isn't that option. And so when you take these as a whole, the United States is saying to the world, just trust us. We are looking at these. We're doing this the right way. And the problem with that is that there are about 70 other countries in the world who have drones. A lot of them are now garnering weaponized drones. So I think, Micah can correct me on this, but I think that there are about 10 countries that actually have weapons attached to their drones. What are they going to do out in the world when they feel like attacking what they call an imminent threat? They're going to say, well, the United States said just trust us. Just trust us to use these in the right way and to make sure that civilians aren't harmed. And that is a real problem.
Do you see that as a real problem, Micah Zinkel?
Yeah, I mean, the spokesperson for this drone campaign within the Obama White House is the senior White House counterterrorism czar, John Brennan. Right. And in a speech he gave where he sort of provided some broad general descriptions of who the U.S. was targeting, he said, "We are establishing precedents that other nations may follow." Sarah's correct. There are something like 70 countries with drones. There may be 10 who have the capability to drop weapons. Nobody has the ability to do long-range distance strikes like the U.S. does, because that requires some level of host nation consent. That requires some combat search and rescue to require armed drones, and it most importantly requires a lot of satellite bandwidth. But still, you look at the number of countries that use lethal force domestically against neighboring countries or potentially against within other states if they're invited by the host government to use it. It would be tremendously worrisome. I mean, the history shows that lots of countries who develop new military capabilities emulate how other countries have developed them. And if you thought about a world where there's characterized by a proliferation of drones, where countries use them with little transparency, oversight, or legal justification, this would work to counter against a lot of stated U.S. foreign policy objectives. So it's something that this administration should be cognizant of, because they're creating the world that America will face in 10 to 15 years.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Micah Zinkel, the Douglas Dillon Fellow in the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. Also, Sarah Holwinski, she's the Executive Director of the Center for Civilians in Conflict. We're talking about drone strikes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Solbury School, a college preparatory day and boarding school for 7th through 12th grade. Located in New Hope, Pennsylvania, Solbury School offers a 1-to-6 teacher-to-student ratio and is committed to intellectual challenge and academic achievement, creative and independent thinking, and respect for individuality and diversity. Their open house is Sunday, October 21st from 1 to 4 p.m. Details at 215-862-5261 or solbury.org.
Phoebe specializes in healthcare, housing, and support services for senior adults. From independent living to rehabilitation services and skilled nursing, Phoebe offers continuing care retirement communities in Lehigh, Berks, Bucks, and Montgomery counties. On November 2nd, Phoebe presents the Institute on Aging Conference, featuring keynote speaker Larry Minix, CEO of Leading Age. The conference focuses on reclaiming advocacy duties to benefit seniors in our communities. Details at phoebe.org. Phoebe Ministries supports WHYY.
The Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia supports WHYY and presents the film Not Much to Do, October 17th at 6 p.m. Made in 1966 by six African-American boys, Not Much to Do depicts the boys' quest for meaningful activities and the challenges of urban renewal in their West Philly neighborhood. A discussion by former project participants, including Oscar-nominated filmmaker Ben Actenberg, will follow. For tickets, history.pcusa.org or 215-928-3895.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're taking a hard and critical look at the U.S. drone program. It's being used as part of the country's counterterrorism strategy. A number of key terrorist leaders have been killed by drone strikes, but we're also talking about its impact on the civilian population. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Brad from Souderton to join us. And Brad, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just had a couple observations about something the guest has said. One with regard to technical capability of a drone. From 20,000 feet, you can't hear those things. You can't even hear a 747 at 20,000 feet, let alone these specially designed aircraft. The other thing, so when they say there's fear on the ground because of the buzzing, that's a total fabrication. That's not true. The other is when they say that they strictly accept the word of the Pakistanis who have been killed, been killed on the ground with no corroborating evidence that they were these. Of course they're going to deny they were terrorists. So it's always children, it's always kids, it's always women. No one is confirming their claim. They're just accepting their word. They're showing their extreme bias by making the very emotional pitch. And the other is the fact that, you know, everybody's afraid that if there were the terrorist friend in the marketplace, these other people will be killed. That goes against the policy. And the last thing I wanted to point out is, if there was a strike on a funeral procession, it could very well have been done by the terrorists themselves for political gain. You're simply accepting the word of those that are being hit without corroborating the evidence and without reviewing the situation.
Well, Brad, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Sarah Holwinski a chance to respond. Go ahead, Sarah.
Sure. There's a lot to unpack there, and they are certainly things that I've heard before. With regard to the buzzing, it actually is true. We've talked to a lot of civilians on the ground. This is what we do. We interview people in conflict zones who are suffering the ramifications of military operations, whether it's the U.S. or Pakistani or Yemen, whatever it happens to be. And in fact, I was just talking with David Rode, who is a journalist that was captured by the Taliban and held hostage in Pakistan. And in fact, he heard the buzzing of drones every single day. They don't stay up at 20,000 feet. They actually come down quite low where you can see them and you can hear them. With regard to this civilian military combatant distinction, we're actually not saying that it's all women and children. Most of the time, the people who are killed are military age men, age about 15 to 70. That doesn't mean that they're terrorists. That doesn't mean that they're combatants. And in fact, it's very difficult to tell them apart, especially when you don't have a full military operation on the ground. So one thing that I would point out is that drones are not necessarily bad. They're not inherently bad. I'm not against drones as a weapon. That's all that they are. It's about how they're used. And if they're used in a place like Afghanistan, with lots of boots on the ground, good intelligence coming up, good intelligence going down, then it's just a weapon. But when you're using them in a place like Pakistan, without a full-scale military operation, then you don't have the ability to see who actually you're killing, especially if you're doing it based on behavior and not actually knowing the person on the ground.
Brad, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mike Azinka, let me go to you, and I hear both of your concerns and criticisms of the drone program, especially for the use of targeting terror suspects. If not a drone program, or if this particular program raises a whole host of questions and concerns about what to do about the threat of terrorism, what do you think, Micah, would be a better strategy or even a better policy?
Well, this issue of what to do about the threat of potential plots against the U.S. homeland from northwest Pakistan or southern Yemen or the coastal areas of Somalia is an important one. And the dichotomy that most people lay out is different types of military force. They say, well, if you don't want to send a bunch of boots on the ground to occupy the country, and that will raise more blowback and anger against the United States, we could use these, and people will somehow find them more tolerable. But of course, nobody pretends, and as anyone in the intelligence community or the military will tell you, that killing individuals from 3,000 to 5,000 feet, and by the way, your caller's wrong. These are very easily heard from everyone on the ground. I was actually speaking to a journalist in North Waziristan on Friday. He says everybody hears them every night. But anyway, the issue is that you're not going to, as the U.S. military likes to say, quote, capture or kill your way out of the problem. Mm-hmm. However, the sort of larger comprehensive strategy that you would need to deal with the threat of violent extremism to the homeland is nothing that the U.S. is implementing currently in any significant way in Yemen, Pakistan, or Somalia. Terrorist threats don't end because you kill everybody. They end them because they're penetrated by intelligence and police forces, and you get to the minds of neutral third parties who have no interest in militancy or international terrorism, but in fact just want to have a life that is one of opportunity and justice and equal protection under the law. This deals with the governance issues in those countries, and the problem is that when policymakers need to do something, whether it's Somalia, Pakistan, or Yemen, nothing does, quote, does something more than using military force, which is an incredibly responsive and impressive tool. But all the other strategies that you would need to actually deal and resolve some of these threats is something that the U.S. is not very good at, but it is very good at drone strikes.
But would it be fair to say that terrorist organizations have killed more civilians than drone strikes, Micah?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, in Afghanistan, for example, under UN estimates, 85% of all the civilians that are killed are killed by members of the Taliban. And in Pakistan, both the local Taliban members and the Arab and Uzbek members of Al-Qaeda who are there, target the local tribal leaders, and they do fight the army because essentially their goals are domestic, right, which is to maybe take down the apostate regime in Islamabad to fight a defensive jihad against the army and hopefully to get the U.S. out of Afghanistan. But this is different than whether or not they're conducting and planning plots against the U.S. homeland. And again, the U.S. claims that the only people who are ever targeted with drones are engaged in imminent plots against the homeland. But in fact, that's not what they're doing.
Sarah, you want to add to that and we'll get back to our callers.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what the U.S. is facing right now in its drone program is looking at the short-term gains versus the long-term strategy of counterterrorism. And as Micah said, you don't kill your way out of terrorism and threats of terrorism. And I think, you know, the short-term gains, we've heard constantly about militants being killed, we're stopping attacks on the United States. In the long term, I think the U.S. really needs to consider what kind of precedent it's setting and whether or not it's creating more anger, more terrorism in the world against it because of the anger that it's causing on the ground. People only need an excuse to be angry at America.
Let me get, looks like Steve from Ocean City to join us on Radio Times. And Steve, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're
it's a wonderful
welcome.
Show. I really appreciate the hard and critical look you're having today.
Thank you.
Just to start, I mean, it's no small wonder why the U.S. government doesn't recognize the International Court at The Hague, because our leaders would all be in the dock. But what I'm calling about is basically the legislation that doesn't prohibit militarized and surveillance drones to be flown over the United States airways in 2015, September of 2015. And I would like to hear your guests comment on the implications of this that has been voted for by our Congress and I believe approved by our President.
Well,
thank
Steve,
you.
You're welcome, Steve. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. I'm going to toss it to you, Micah Zenko.
Well, currently, anybody who flies anything over a couple hundred feet in the air that is not just a small remotely piloted aircraft requires a certificate of authorization from the FAA. The FAA has given out something like 250 to 300 of these, primarily to police, research organizations, some universities, people doing environmental and wildlife surveillance with them. But the caller is right. By 2015, under U.S. law, the FAA is supposed to develop a nationwide system whereby unarmed drones could be integrated into the U.S. airspace. So you think about all the planes that fly all the time and all the air traffic controllers and all the monitoring and radars required to know where they are. You're going to have to integrate drones into that as well. Now, the problem is, obviously, do drones have the situational awareness of a manned aircraft? Does it have the sense and survivability of somebody at the stick in the air versus somebody controlling it from the ground? Does it have 360 view perspective of where they are? Those are really good questions. I would add that there's no plans right now to fly armed drones over the United States. And in fact, last year there was a voice vote in the House of Representatives which prohibits the Department of Homeland Security for ever arming any drones it has on the United States. But needless to say, people are rightfully paranoid about what this will look like when they're flying over, when local police force use them, when Customs Border Protection uses them for a range of missions, civil liberties, and legal issues.
Let me get, Steve, thanks for the call. Let me get Pam from Queen Village to join us on Radio Times, and I'll give you a chance, Sarah, to respond to Pam's comment. Go ahead, Pam, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just wondering, you keep saying the guests, keep saying how opaque and secretive these drones are and the government's plans and processes with them. So I'm just wondering, how do you know all these specific stats and data and why they're doing this? And you seem to know a lot of information for an opaque program, and I'm just wondering why should I trust you and not the government?
Pam, it's a fair question. And Sarah, go ahead. The ball in your court.
Sure. It's a good question, Pam, and we actually don't know very much. I mean, what we know is because of things that the that U.S. officials have said either in testimony or in leaks. There's a lot of senior administration officials who are not very pleased with the drone program and actually leak quite a few of these details to the media. But let me give you examples of things that we don't know that we should. And I think this is really important because Americans don't realize that we are at war, that this country is at war. Despite troops coming out of Afghanistan and out of Iraq, we are at war through the drone program. And so Americans need to understand the details of what we're doing or what is being done in our name overseas. So when you look at a military operation, as I've been doing for the past 10 years in Afghanistan or in Iraq, the U.S. military is actually quite good now about sharing information about, you know, here's the strike that happened, here's our investigation, here's what we found, yes, we did cause civilian harm, here's how we know that we did, these sorts of things. They're also fairly good about training the people that they have in targeting positions who are going to push that button to kill somebody about the local culture, about civilian protection, about the rules of war. We don't know any of that about the drone program. And it's kind of ironic because if we are at war in a place like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, just as we were at war in a place like Afghanistan or Iraq, then shouldn't the information that is coming out that the American public gets about how the U.S. is using force, shouldn't that be the same? And it's not.
Pam, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mike, let me go back to you because as we are talking about these drone strikes and obviously the various questions that it raises, I'm thinking about World War II, the bombing of Dresden, for instance. I mean, how do we compare and contrast if we are at war, and clearly we are, what is the best way to fight that war?
Well, again, it assumes that the war requires, of all the elements of national power that America has, that it requires a sole and over-reliance on military force. And if you take that mindset, then drones have several advantages over using special operations raids or manned aircraft or offshore cruise missiles. I mean, they're very you can have persistence over the target. They're very responsive because you essentially have the surveillance ability and the missile on the same weapons platform. They tend to be more precise, and when the intelligence is good, which you never know, they tend to kill less civilians, or I should say cause less collateral damage. But the fact of the matter is that if you assume that military force is required, drones might be a way to go about it. But I would agree that the United States has been doing this for 10 years outside of Iraq and Afghanistan in four countries, 400 targeted killings that have killed 3 to 3,500 people. And the only information we have about this is what the administration has essentially couched in basically in just this year. And to just answer your other caller's questions, the reason we know a lot about this is because really brave and courageous activists and lawyers and journalists in Pakistan and Yemen and in East Africa who have problems and questions with how the U.S. is using military force within its countries. It's not because of the governments themselves there who largely provide tacit support to the U.S. doing these strikes. And I would also add that there are many current and former officials who are more than happy to talk to you about this program because they have real problems about where this is heading and where the American use of force has gone.
And Sarah, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, there was some polling. It's hard to know if the results of this poll are reliable in that the public doesn't largely think about a drone program. But there seems to be U.S. support for a drone program, unlike the rest of the world. How do you understand why Americans largely favor this drone program?
Well, it's very understandable, actually, because our soldiers, our troops, our sons and daughters are not being killed in this kind of conflict as they were and as they sacrificed so much in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you have drone operations, and our troops don't need to go over there and don't need to put themselves in harm's way. I think, though, that the American public does need to understand the long-term ramifications of this drone program, regardless of whether soldiers are being sacrificed.
And the long-term effect is a destabilizing one?
It can be. It absolutely has been destabilizing in these conflict zones, Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, those. But it also creates so much anger against the United States that the short-term gains in killing militants may be outweighed by the long-term ramifications of people being incredibly angry and displeased and disgruntled with the United States and its leadership in use of force.
Well, my thanks to both of you for talking about this important issue. Sarah Holwinski, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
She's the head of the Center for Civilians in Conflict. And Mike Ozenko, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome. He's a fellow at the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out about all the exciting and various social network programs that we have. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.